the Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
I'm Richard Allen, and you're listening to the Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
Okay, welcome back to the Sports Coaching Podcast with me, Sam Holmshaw. As always, we hope everyone is well and doing okay and keeping busy and keeping occupied in this strange time that just seems to be never ending at the minute. But absolutely delighted to welcome my final guest of season three today, Mr. Richard Allen. Richard, how are you doing? How are you? All the way down in Loughborough, I believe.
Now up in sunny Nottingham today. So,
Nottingham.
Up here, it's not too bad. I had quite a bit of snow recently, but yeah, keeping good, mate. How about yourself?
Yeah, we're really, really good, to be fair, as good as we can be. Let me ask you, I always do every guest, how's the whole, you know, coronavirus impacted you? How's it impacted your coaching, your study? Managed to, you know, adapt to it okay? Managed to, get through it?
You know what? I was actually speaking to my wife about this the other day. I think it's been really a productive time. I think to develop myself as a person, a little boy is, 18 months now, to see him develop all over lockdown. And I think because of the environment, us being at home more, like him being able to see us more, it's just developed and flourished loads. In terms of my coaching, I think the last, probably from midsummer, when we could get back up and coaching again, I think that was probably... You know, as I think coaches have form, and I think I was, you know, probably on form, the best I've ever had, you know, for that 6 month period, you know, from just working with so many different players, from a business through like Loughborough Foxes. So, yeah, no class to be fair, mate. So, yeah, I tried to put a positive spin on that. Really, really, really productive time, you know, despite all the constraints that surround us on a daily basis.
Yeah. Well, no, that's really, really great to hear. It's been positive for you. And I love how you've just thrown in the word constraints there as a true academic man studying a master's. Fantastic. So, yeah, you know, as we do, if you don't mind, Richard, just giving us a run through of, you know, your coaching journey or your journey of study and what's kind of led you to the route you are today and your business. That'd be great for myself and the listeners just to give a bit of an introduction to yourself.
Yeah, so I've been coaching for about 10 years, just over 10 years since I left school. Probably wasn't what I always wanted to do. I wanted to be in sport, so went down the analysis route, and I've kind of gone full circle now. So started off just coaching locally, as many of us do. And then I thought, how can I access an elite environment without having to wait ages and ages to get all my coaching qualifications? So I went down the analysis route, and that gave me lots of access to, you know, working with first team. So I was in working for Prozone. Back in the day, they were a big company, which is now Catapult. Did some work there with Euros back in 2012. At the same time, I was an intern with the Forest first team. So I was being exposed to loads of great environments. At the same time, I started to get into women's football as well. So that was a time when I took on probably one of the biggest challenges was coaching under 13s and under 15s girls team. And anyone that coaches girls football, you'll completely understand and empathise me when I say that. It was an absolutely fantastic experience. Went on from there, went into Forest Women, Derby Women, and then I went back into academy football. So that was the time when I got my B licence, went back into academy, stayed there for a few years. Did a little bit on and off with my business RDA coaching. Start to get into tutoring, did a bit of coach education. And yeah, to where I am now. So joined Loughborough Foxes last year, left Forest Academy. Joined Loughborough Foxes, wanted to work more in a senior environment with the Lenby 11. Just challenged myself a little bit more, really. Here we are today.
Fantastic. So, I mean, you know, sort of coming from a performance analyst route, and I had a very, very brief step in that with where I had an internship with Barnsley for maybe about 2 or 3 months. So, you know, sort of coming from that route, do you think that gave you more knowledge from sort of a tactical perspective as a coach? Because I certainly know, sort of stepping back into it now with my own performance analyst at Oakley's first team, it, even now I feel like I'm learning more about the game just through sort of, you know, stripping it back and re-watching clips and watching how that works and from a tactical viewpoint. So, you know, would you say that impacted you in any way in terms of your coaching now?
Yeah, a good mentor of mine said to me once, you know, focus on one player and you see the whole picture. I mean, that's the paradox of doing analysis. So I started to watch a few individuals, started to pick out a few sort of performances. And then, yeah, you start to like really look into like, I was always into more like qualitative analysis. So I was all about, you know, how can we work in this player's like individual learning plan? Never been massive on stats, but if they provide relevance to what we do, like all for it. So yeah, no, analysis was a big part of what I do now, even in terms of like the video editing, like picking out clips of players, just allowing them to frame stuff or see things in a different perspective. One of the best things I did was a couple of years ago, actually went to Benfica's academy and just like basically shadowed their analysis department for about a month. It was absolutely brilliant. You know, got to see how they did stuff and how they were quite creative with what they got. You know, you'd think, you know, someone in that department would like have all the resources. They did have a few bits, but at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that we had at Forest that they didn't have. So it was really interesting to see how they like picked out and fed back information to players and also coaches as well. So I think through like practice design, through like ball rolling time. So I did like a little project at Forest as well, where we had the 15s and 16s coaches, and I basically broke down all their coach interventions, how long they were spending doing each intervention, like command, question, answer, how long the ball rolling time was. And then based on that, we could say to them, well, if you want 8% ball rolling time, you can only speak for 5 minutes out of 30. So then we add on a stopwatch, and yeah, it was a really good idea and it worked really well. But then again, I don't know, because how powerful it was, I'm not sure if other clubs do that. But yeah, when we did it, it was really powerful. But yeah, in short, a really powerful tool. I just think we're consumed by information at the moment. But yeah, I think if we're able to pick out the key bits, I think it can be really valuable and really powerful.
Yeah, brilliant. No, really brilliant. You know, sort of sell for it, really. I mean, yeah, fantastic. And, you know, I suppose as well, let me ask you about, you know, your coaching company, RDA Coaching. Tell us a bit about that and, you know, how it started. And, you know, I've seen your videos online. It looks absolutely brilliant, the work you're doing. So, yeah, just give us a bit of a run through on that, Richard.
Oh, thank you for your kind words. So, yeah, it started about 5 years ago. So I'd say it's had about two stages in the development so far. So it was just me, sort of one-man band for about 4 or 5 years. Yeah, to be fair, it was never about making money. It was all about how can I challenge myself as a coach? How can I give myself access to working with lots of different players? I think especially if you work in like a boys academy environment or anyone's working in like a club, I think sometimes you feel a little bit restricted to who you can work with. But that gave me a vehicle to work with lots of different players, lots of different ages. And also, yeah, some of the players that I used to coach years and years back are coming back to me now asking for coaching. So, yeah, I think it's had a few involvements. A lot of the stuff we do is one-to-one coaching. That's been quite popular, especially over lockdown. But we've done like coach mentoring in the past, like performance analysis. So yeah, it's been great. And then last year, we got to a point where I took on two business partners, Dave and Jonas, who are absolutely fantastic. You know, both from very different backgrounds, but in terms of what we can offer, I think, you know, really excited to what can happen over the next couple of years, really. So yeah, we've gone from working with, you know, just mostly kind of like grassroots players, and then we had like women senior players interested, to now WSL and Premier League players. So yeah, it's, you know, to, like I said, you know, that last 6 months for me was probably the best experience I've had in terms of coaching, just being able to work with like Premier League players, WSL players. So yeah, it's been really powerful. And yeah, to say where right now, it's yeah, you know, when you asked them that question, it kind of makes me reflect on how far we've traveled. But yeah, no, it's gone really well. And yeah, let's see what happens in the next couple of years.
Yeah, smashing. Well, it's certainly doing great work, so keep up with that. And you know, I think finally, just tell us about your sort of time as a student or studying. I think you've on the masters or just finishing the masters, is that right?
Yeah, so I'm doing it part-time. Yeah, it's a struggle at the time being, you know, managing everything in between. So yeah, doing a teaching degree at the same time, as well as a full-time job. So yeah, I think, yeah, it's a great opportunity to learn. What I wanted to do is, is kind of tap more into the psychology side. So I don't know what it might lead to, whether it's getting to be an accredited sports psychologist, performance psychologist, or just helping my coach. And I think first and foremost, like, how can this help my coaching? And yeah, going to Loughborough University was a great privilege to be in there and learn from some of the best in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been really good so far. And I think one of the projects that I've had, I'm going to talk about today.
Yeah. Smashing. Well, yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing your background. Really interesting to hear your journey. It certainly sounds an exciting one at the minute. So yeah, really, really great stuff, Richard.
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
So yeah, I mean, we decided today we were going to talk about the topic, and we've named the episode, and it's actually after your blog that you shared with me. And I fully enjoyed reading it. So the title of the episode today is Turning Black Coal into Diamonds, Pressure Training. So, you know, certainly something that, to be honest, I've not really had too much experience in myself. I've briefly read into, you know, certain academic articles at times, just briefly exploring. So really excited to get into this topic today, Richard, and learn a bit more around the subject area. So, you know, I suppose to sort of dive straight into the topic today, the idea of pressure training. Well, you know, for the layperson coach or the layperson listener that's never come across that before, doesn't really have a conception of what it is. I suppose, what is pressure training, or what would be pressure training, you know, to you?
So, yeah, I'm sure we're all familiar with athletes that crumble under pressure. And for me, I've always been fascinated into why to do that. So why... You know, why do players miss penalties? Why do players, how are they so consistent for so long? And then for some reason, they crumble under pressure and something completely out of the norm happens to them. So I've always been curious to why that happens. And then I've reflected back on my own coaching practice and, well, how can we help athletes thrive in those kind of situations, especially in the performance environment, when he has to do it with mitigating factors, for example, like the crowds, the referee, the opposition. Things in football, someone's trying to stop you doing something all the time, compared to other sports where, you know, you might be on the post. Football, someone is directly trying to stop you perform your action. So yeah, the analogy was, and there's a bit of irony and a slight paradox in the title. The paradox is that by actually, you know, putting athletes under a little bit more pressure, they can actually thrive under pressure rather than go the other way. I think if we protect them a little bit too much, then we're not really preparing them for the right environment. You know, and this, like, I'll go on to talk about it a little bit more, but this isn't for every athlete. You know, there's going to be different stages that I'll go into in terms of, like, who can be ready, who you might use it with. But yeah, I just find it's a really good tool. And, you know, from testimony from players that I've worked with, both in the women's game, the men's game, you know, players that play at a really high level, you know, it's got good feedback. And I think they sort of enjoy the challenge.
Yeah, fantastic. So, you know, I suppose, I mean, I've got a bit of an idea in my head, but when we're talking about pressure training, why is it important for, you know, the player or the athlete? Why do they need to be subjected to or a similar form of that pressure in the training environment that ultimately they're going to experience in the game environment? Why is that really important for the athlete, you know, especially when we're expecting, you know, to make high level decisions, we're thinking about the professional level of sport?
Yeah, so I think it's important that they can feel confident that their technique won't falter and they can execute their decisions no matter what happens. So you're almost like coming back to like being like a bulletproof athlete, you know, from no matter what's thrown at them. And this is why I think it's really good for us as coaches to take ourselves out of the comfort zone and think, well, how can we then challenge players a little bit more, put ourselves out of the comfort zone, put them out of the comfort zones, but obviously still support them at the same time. But yeah, the main thing is, you know, how can we help athletes to thrive under that pressure? And the pressure could be quite tangible. It could be internal, external. It could come from outside factors like the crowds. It could come from maybe they're turning up to a previous venue that they're not too fond of. Maybe something's happened there before. Maybe something sentimental. So, yeah, there's so many things that could surround pressure. But, yeah, I think one of the best case studies is probably looking at England and their sort of World Cup penalty success over the sort of last three, four decades. And yeah, there's a little bit in the article that I wrote about that, you know, just being able to, and another paradox, we all think that taking less time to go up to penalties is actually something better. And, you know, being players who want to just rush and get it over and done with, a lot of the time they'll miss the penalties because they've not processed and thought about what they want to do. But the irony is that by taking less, well, taking more time, having a few breaths, taking your heart rate down, being more composed, directing your attention, it can significantly impact your technique. And there's loads of research suggests that taking more time in penalties is more beneficial, more successful. So, yeah, I think, you know, looking at both ends of the spectrum, really, like looking at, you know, how elite performers thrive under pressure, and, you know, just like grassroots or academy kids, how they can thrive under pressure. I think there's loads of similarities, but yeah, definitely think there's value in doing it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there certainly is from my perspective. And you know, you mentioned the, you know, the term athletes choking under pressure. I think, you know, the idea of choking in performance, I've certainly come across that quite a lot of times in, you know, in terms of my academic study. So, you know, for the listener, what does that mean, athlete choking it? And what, you know, why does that happen? How does that happen? You know, why can, you know, that really be significant on, or detrimental, should we say, to the athlete's performance?
Well, I think for me, it's a significant change in behaviour. And it could be through different processes that the athlete goes through. So, for example, if we're expecting someone to do something completely normal, like put a pass together or execute a skill, if it's a complete change in behaviour and it's abnormal to what they're doing, then, yeah, a lot of people would say, yeah, they choke then. So, for example, John Terry's penalty in the 2008 Champions League final, you look at, you know, these events can almost tarnish, you know, for a 1 or 2 second event, it can almost, you know, tarnish a player's career. Look at Karius in the 2018 Champions League final, you know, a couple of mistakes, and that still affected him now, both mentally and psychologically. It's kind of affected his career. So, you know, for me, I'm really curious, you know, why are these athletes choking? Why is this like abnormal behaviour from what they normally do? Yeah. And for me, it's brought about from a change of behaviour because of the circumstances, or because they've not been prepared for that situation. So have they, you know, whilst we can't fill a stadium full of 80,000 people, how can we creatively put them under pressure where something's on the line? So they can kind of thrive in that situation, as opposed to like doing their best just to survive and keep the head above water. So yeah, by giving them psychological tools and building their psychological skills in terms of how to process stuff, how to frame stuff, how their perspective is, and how they can sort of internalize that pressure, I think that's really important. Because I think if we don't do that, then we're probably doing our athletes a disservice.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly agree with you. And I suppose, you know, we'll save the, you know, how we're going to, you know, implement pressure training into our sessions just for the next segment. But, you know, the whole, you know, idea of pressure training, and, you know, I guess the, you know, when it was first sort of, you know, brought to light, when did this kind of start, you know, being involved in, you know, in terms of the game? Because you think about, like you say, you know, over the last, you know, 30, 40 years with England missing the penalties, and there was always that pressure around the England players. And you can see, you know, even now it's still a thing in the back of the mind. So, you know, I suppose for, you know, for managers, coaches, psychologists, when did this kind of come to light that actually maybe we should be thinking about subjecting our players to a similar form of pressure so they can actually deal with that better in the game environment?
Yeah, I think it's quite a contemporary topic. I think over... sometimes it takes events to build up for someone to say, right, we need to change what happens. So, you know, so many England managers have tried to change the techniques of how England approach penalties, whether they just get them to practice it before, whether they do it in front of a crowd. You know, there's so much research that's gone into that. So, yeah, you know, not to discredit all the previous England managers, they've all tried it, they've all recognised it. And then probably up until Southgate, where he recognised, right, we need to change the heart rate, need to get this down, need to make him take longer with the penalties, need to have a consequence in training, you know, to allow him to make it a little bit more realistic to the game. I think it's been around for quite a few times. And I think if you date back to perhaps coaching in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I'm sure there'd be many, many professional players, and many players are probably subdued to either consequences, whether, you know, they had to clean a player's boots, or whether they had to do like all these silly things as a result of not performing a task in training, or maybe they were late. You know, so I think subconsciously, this has been around for quite a few years, but certainly over the last decade, we've seen a change in how coaches manipulate practice design, how they use creatively use constraints within the practice to make deliberate interventions to try and bring out this kind of pressure enormous. So, yeah, certainly over the last decade, it's probably developed more so than ever. But I think it's been inherent certainly over the last sort of 30, 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Managers and coaches doing it without realizing what they were kind of doing. Yeah. No, fantastic, fantastic run through.
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
Yeah, so, I guess this kind of moves us on to our next segment then. So, you know, for people listening, for people who are interested in this, well, how do we, you know, as coaches, really begin to, you know, use pressure training or implement that into our practice? So, you know, on your blog, I remember you wrote three specific points. So if you would mind going through all three, just, you know, I suppose we'll stop and discuss after each one. But yeah, how does the coach really begin to implement that into their practice, Richard?
So, yeah, I think the foundation before we go on to any of this, like the coach-athlete relationship is completely paramount. It's integral. It's critical. In many ways, I think for you, you have to understand your player. They have to understand you. And if that trust isn't there, then you can't even begin to even think about using pressure training, because you're making them uncomfortable, and you're taking them out of their comfort zone. And you're almost making them a little bit vulnerable, because on the line of whatever you're putting them through is their ego. You know, their ego could be compromised, their self-worth. So I think it's just about finding that balance, really. But yeah, fundamentally, the coach-athlete relationship is so, so important. It's absolutely critical. And yeah, if I reflect back to perhaps my sort of earlier coaching, probably put players under a little bit too much pressure before the coach-athlete relationship was kind of fully developed. And, you know, on the back of that, you know, maybe players didn't trust me as much, or maybe they didn't buy into what I was trying to do. But I think if those foundations are put in place, then it definitely gives you a good platform to start using these kind of constraints.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fantastic point. And, you know, I can remember in my earlier days, maybe 2 or 3 years back, I think when I kind of, you know, briefly sort of was introduced to the topic at uni or just through reading, the teams we were coaching, we try and, you know, implement, you know, and kind of put them to pressure. I can remember in one session specifically really refereeing really badly and, you know, sort of saying to the players afterwards, well, you know, this is what you might be subjected to in the game. So, you know, you've got to be ready to deal with that pressure. But, you know, we certainly didn't have that, you know, coach-athlete relationship developed. We certainly didn't have enough trust. And I can remember a lot of the parents coming up and, you know, saying, well, you know, training's not fun for him, all this. And I think that's just such a fantastic point, isn't it? I mean, you know, how important is it making the athlete or the parent, whatever, you know, certain age group you're working with, even your coaches, you know, conscious to what you're doing it and why you're doing it?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, you probably go into the personal qualities of the athlete. And I think a lot of these are, you know, subconsciously, we can probably comment around, you know, the psychological makeup and the emotional well-being of the player. So we can probably think of quite a few things, you know, about a lot of our players that we work with around, you know, psychological makeup. Are they ready for pressure normal training? Like how they respond to it. So yeah, I think the personal qualities of the athlete and this is just like their personal factors as well. So what's going off at home, what's valuable to them, what you know, for me, you don't want to use anything within that pressure normal that's going to sort of affect their well-being. So you'd never want to, you know, have something on the line where it affects their kind of well-being psychologically and emotionally, especially in the current climate that we're in. But at the same time, you know, the more we get to know the athlete, the more we can engage in these conversations when running off the pitch. I think that's absolutely paramount, really. Just getting to know the athletes a little bit more, and then we can kind of know what makes them tick. So, for example, so one of the players that I work with at Forest from the internship, I've sort of kept in touch with him, And yeah, he's still playing now. So we've done some one-to-one sessions with him, and you know, we used to see each other at gigs all the time. We used to go to, like, you know, like live gigs and stuff. So we like the same music. So I know what makes him tick. So I said to him, right, you don't score this penalty, you go a day without Spotify, you get a day without all these certain artists. And yeah, you know, the look in his face, just thought, right, I've got to nail this in. And you could see his body shape was a little bit more rigid. Like, he was a little bit, yeah, certainly a change in his behaviour. He thought, right, I've got to nail this one. And I've never seen him hit a ball so hard. Like, he had to do that. So yeah, I think like just knowing the athlete, really, just knowing what makes him tick. For example, with a lot of girls that we work with, you know, our sort of, you know, prime the makeup is in the hair straightener. So, right, you know, you don't do this. You don't get your hair straighteners for 2 days. Or, right, I know you're going out on Saturday, so you ain't going to have makeup for that. And, or, right, your parents standing over there, or your mum, your dad, whoever's over there, right, they're going to pick a day when you can't go on your Xbox. So, yeah, just by knowing the athlete and what makes them tick, I think just putting little constraints in there is, you know, it just makes things more fun and varied and interesting, really. I think that's it for me. Just adds a different element to the session. And equally, it's important for me as a coach to be, like, vulnerable myself. So, you know, if, for example, if there's a physical challenge on the back of it, you know, then I do it as well. Or there's an opportunity for the athlete to spin the challenge back on me. And that's always interesting, because I certainly noticed a change in my behaviour as well when I, you know, got to work harder. So, for example, if it saves me running, I'd rather run 10 yards to stop them scoring and them achieving the challenge rather than me, like, run the full length of the pitch. So for me, that's a bit of a motivation, bit of an incentive. But yeah, I think there's a great bit in, you know, Andy Murray's documentary that, I think it's resurfaced on Amazon Prime. There's a great bit in there that's on the blog, and he talks about, you know, the coaches joining in, and he went through a horrible time in terms of his recovery. He went through so many different things in terms of his kind of rehab stages, and the coaches joining in, it just allowed him to think, well, actually, they're in it with me. They want to go through the same things. They know how hard I work. Mm. And yeah, for me, like, some of the challenges when, you know, I think to myself, yeah, I regret saying that, but on the back of it, there's so many positive things that come out of it, and they can obviously see that I'm in it for the right reasons, and yeah, they can see my vulnerability as well. And it obviously, you know, going back to the coach athlete relationship, it certainly accelerates that kind of bonding and that kind of level of trust.
I mean, I think they're brilliant examples, actually. And some that, you know, for coaches, you wouldn't always think about. But yeah, I mean, it certainly does, like you say, link back to, you know, having that coach athlete relationship in place and knowing your athlete as a person and who they are outside of football as well as in it. You know, and I guess, you know, thinking about you know, the knowledge domain as well for pressure training, I guess it's important to, you know, understand where they're at in terms of their age and stage of development as well. So physical, psychological, social, is that right?
Yeah, so things for me, I think a lot of the time in academic framework and a lot of time in coaching framework, there's a lot of research into the how and the what and maybe the why, but there's not necessarily much research about the when. So my kind of quest with the blog and my research was how can we get a framework to know when we're actually going to use this? Because I think we can all kind of think of elements where we probably wouldn't use it. So if the athlete has had a bad day, or if they're coming in and maybe they've had something going off at home, you know, so I think we can all kind of judge the athlete that's right there in front of us when we might or might not use it. In terms of providing that little bit more of a robust framework, there's a couple of parameters we can work off. So I did a lot of research with a tennis coach called Calvin Betton a couple of years ago. Still keep in touch with him now, like, absolutely brilliant guy. And yeah, he had this framework that basically said you develop technique and skill through different stages, and when you get up to the stage where you're trying to put it into a bit of under a skill, then it's got to be under pressure. Like, you know, there's so many practices out there that I see, like, under no pressure at all, and that's not even talking about pressure training, like, nothing's opposed. And I think it has to be opposed. When they get to that point where it is opposed, then for me, there's a little bit of an area and a little bit of percentage that you can work out. So for example, if I'm a striker and I've got four shots at goal, if I score at least two out of four, then for me that gives you 50% of success. If they're getting two out of four, then it probably suggests that they're ready for the next challenge. So then that's where we're coming with a bit of pressure intervention. So on the next round or the next lot of four, we say, right, if you don't score two out of four, then this is the consequence. Or if you do score two out of four, you get a free session. Or if you score two out of four, then, you know, you win a prize or you get to put a challenge back on me. So it just, you know, although you're doing the same thing, it just adds that little bit of variety to what you're doing. Certainly, I think it allows us to put some parameters in. Now, for me, that little hot spot and that little sweet spot of 50 to 75%, that's kind of parameters for when to introduce pressure training. If they're getting below 50% success, then you need to keep working at it. You need to let them struggle. You need to recognize when to fine tune that pressure. So it's, for me, the analogy is almost like a barometer in terms of measuring that pressure, but also imagine you're trying to fine tune a radio. Probably kids that probably won't appreciate this in terms of radio, you know, back in from when me and you were probably growing up, you're there for ages trying to get it onto the right channel. And for me, when you do get it and you turn it to that right channel, then that's where athletes can thrive. If equally they're getting over 75% success, then you need to really put them under pressure. You need to make it harder for them. So that sweet spot of getting 50 to 75% success for me is an opportunity where you can sort of use these pressure interventions. Yeah. Equally, with the RPE, so rate of perceived exertion, if they're looking at, you know, 8, 9, 10 out of 10, then, yeah, you've probably got them in a sweet spot. But if they're telling you that, yeah, maybe I'm a 6 or 7 out of 10, then, yeah, that's probably based on your knowledge of what their physical threshold is. That's where you can start to really put them under a little bit more pressure and change the sort of practice design.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I mean, you know, first, I think that's a great run through of the idea of when you're so right. That's often not always discussed in the sports coaching academic literature. And, you know, just thinking then, you know, when you're talking about opposed and unopposed practice, you know, I know loads of parents, I think, who would, you know, turn around and say, well, you know, shouldn't youth development be more about fun and enjoyment, you know, rather than putting these athletes under pressure? But what they always seem to forget is that, you know, training must represent the game. And at the end of the day, you can't then be screaming at your kid or being, you know, understanding why your kid's not, you know, coping under pressure or, you know, really, you know, battling on the pitch. And at the end of the day, it is an invasion sport. If they're not put under that same pressure in the game, you know, I think that's often at times where I think maybe there's a slight misunderstanding that, yes, you know, we want it to be about fun and enjoyment, particularly at that youth development phase. But at the same time, we do have to put some pressure in to prepare these young athletes. You know, certainly if we're thinking about an academy environment, you know, and these kids have got aspirations to go and play semi-pro professional football. I mean, you know, how important is it for parents to kind of understand that, would you say, or coaches as well?
Yeah, great point. I think we can't have it both ways. We can't complain that players need to be put under no pressure at all and need to get success in training. But then when it comes to a game, we throw our arms up everywhere and then we're really agitated when they can't do it under pressure. I think we can't have it both ways. So, and a lot of the players, you know, this goes on to the age appropriateness of it as well. There's so many ways that I use like pressure normal training with like 9, 10, 11 year olds. And look, I'm not asking them to do lengths of the pitch afterwards or anything like that. It's little things that make them tick. So we had a big theme around Jaffa Cakes at Forest last year. So whether that's, you know, being on time or whether that's getting success in a game or whether that's, you know, even like the social stuff. So if they complimented a teammate or if they did something really well, then yeah, they get rewarded with Jaffa Cakes. But equally, if they forgot something, then they have to bring a box of Jaffa Cakes to. So it's just like little themes that, you know, I'm sure there's loads out there that you can do. But yeah, I think it's really important to, you know, for us as coaches and parents to understand that, you know, you are gonna see your player or your son or your daughter. You're gonna see them struggle in the short term, but that's with a view to the long term. They're gonna be thriving under pressure. Yeah. So yeah, you know, there's, you know, success leaves clues. So for me, when you look at the best players, they would have had to be put under pressure at some moment in their career. Otherwise, you know, you can go all the way through singing and dancing, all the way through to, you know, youth development phase, up to, you know, being a professional player or being a senior player. And yeah, that's where it's going to falter. And I'm sure the players, when they get to that age, I'm sure they'll thank you for, you know, all the hardship and all the things that you went through. You know, building that relationship and putting them under pressure. I'm sure they'll be more thankful when you prepare them more for that situation when it really counts. So yeah, I think it's massively important for the coaches and parents to understand that, because otherwise we're not preparing them for it.
Yeah,
I think I heard a great quote from Steve Garnon, who is a former professional. He commented on my Twitter saying, the match is like an exam. Like, if we don't prepare players for it, then we aren't doing a job. Like, you'd never even dream of not preparing someone for a maths test, you know, without going through the right things with the exam papers, the previous questions, all the revisions, the algebra, the fractions. You'd never even dream of not putting that under pressure at some stage. Now, obviously it looks different in the classroom compared to being on the pitch, but I think there's a lot of value in training and how you play. I think there's so much value in doing that. And that's testament from a lot of players that I work with. And I think that's why they come to RDA coaching, because unless they're challenged, they probably won't come to us. They probably know it's going to be hard. They know it's going to be difficult. And they're going to be pushed out of the comfort zone. Otherwise, they wouldn't come in the first place. So, yeah, if it was easy, then like anyone can do it. But I think because they're going to be challenged and put out of the comfort zone, and maybe, you know, it's that excitement, you know, going into a session, you know, they're not knowing what to expect. A lot of these times when, you know, I use pressure training, a lot of it's spontaneous. So, you know, sometimes if an athlete, you know, depending on how they are in the day, depending on what they've gone through, like, for example, I think Christmas was a great time when we did a lot of sessions. You know, they would have, you can spin a few things. I think one of them was, I was working with a 16-year-old and his little sister's probably about 10, 11. And they said, look, if you don't score these two free kicks, you have to tell her two presents that you bought her, even though you've wrapped them, you have to tell her what they are. And he's like, oh no, I can't do that. I've worked so hard to wrap him. It's like, I can't undo all of that. And yeah, it was, you know, the execution in his free kicks was so good.
Yeah.
Just to save himself from doing that. So I think it's a fine art of doing it. Obviously, you don't want to do it all the time, because then athletes become reliant on being under pressure. I think it has to come intrinsically from themselves. So I think sometimes you just got to let athletes crack on with it, because if they're only motivated when you put them under pressure, then yeah, you know, they have to be intrinsically motivated at the same time. So they have to do it for the right reasons. They have to do it for the value of performing that technique or skill.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there's a time and a place for it. It's not all the time, but yeah, certainly using it, it's a good vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's it certainly is a fascinating insight. And, you know, I'm sat here thinking, you know, this is such an interesting concept that I've, you know, I certainly think that sometimes isn't, you know, sort of promoted enough or talked about enough in the coaching world. So yeah, absolutely fascinating stuff.
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
You know, if we move to that next bullet point within your blog, and, you know, that was around fine-tuning pressure with the constraints-led approach. So, you know, do you want to give us an idea of that, and maybe just briefly introduce the constraints-led approach to any that are not really aware of it, you know, and quite a brief idea, if you like, if we can do that with the CLA approach?
Yeah, I don't want to undermine a lot of the research that goes out there, but for me, from both what I've researched and what I've done on the grass, for me, constraints is just about putting conditions, a set of rules, or manipulating the practices to try and bring out a different outcome. So whether that's the way that we shape practices, whether that's the way that maybe instead of a rectangle, maybe we'll put a circle in, you know, all of these can bring out different affordances. And what affordances are, different opportunities that players can explore. So for example, if we had a 2v2 in a rectangle, if we did that in a triangle where it's wider at one end compared to another end, then it certainly changes the way in which athletes approach that, and it changes their behaviours. So I think the beauty of constraints is, you know, we're absolutely strapped for time. You know, if we get out of lockdown, we might only have, you know, 3-4 weeks, touch wood, but we might only have a limited time before we go back into another lockdown, or we might only have a limited amount of games, you know, because maybe we only play teams like home or away. So I think with that limited time, I think the constraints-led approach, it can certainly accelerate learning through, you know, creatively putting rules on the practices, for having individual constraints and team constraints as well, you know, putting little rules on things. And I think these can be really creative in how you do it. So yeah, linking back to pressure norming training, all this can really sort of aid your athletes to sort of thrive under pressure. So I remember doing a session a few weeks ago, and we had sort of half our space cut down because another, I think basically the venue double booked. So what happened was we had half the space to work on, but it kind of really honed in on where the athlete was working on. So there was a left wing back, and it almost, like, you know, for anyone that's done a B license, it almost brought the session almost like a bit of a function. So we had literally a quarter of the pitch to work in. But what that did, it kind of really, you know, it kind of gave almost, like, without even doing too much, that natural constraint or ecological constraint of just having less space and time. You know, that for me was a vehicle for them to explore loads of kind of match realistic situations that they'd be in with the time and the space. So yeah, if you think about the time and the space that they went through, you know, it certainly helped them execute their skills under pressure. And in terms of where it could take them, they were doing stuff that's realistic to what they're going to do on a match day. And I was so thankful of it. You know, I said, look, I know this looks a bit, you know, not normal, because I know we normally get half a pitch and stuff, but I said, look, stick with it. And, you know, she was absolutely buzzing by the end of it. And it got her to a point where she probably wouldn't have got had that constraint not been in place at the time. So yeah, like I said before, with we constraints, I think there's so much out there. So, you know, in terms of how we use them, the three R's are great. So Ben Bartlett, who's head of coaching at Fulham, he did loads of research with the FA around the three R's. So restricting practices. So for example, if I said to a player, right, if you don't do this, then this happens. So for example, if they kick the ball out of play, you have to go off the pitch for 10 seconds. So, you know, there's a consequence to it. So, you know, you'd like to think over a period of time, or if they pass backwards, it's a free kick. So, you know, you go on a spot, or like you said, with your bad refereeing earlier, that's a restriction, because you're restricting their decisions in order to make them alter their behaviour. And I think these could be really positive as well. So, you know, a lot of the time we say, you know, play off two touch, but why are we doing that? You know, why? You know, I remember doing two touch as a kid, and I never saw the value in doing it. You know, what if it's four or five touches? What if I need to play off one touch? So, yeah, I think restrictions, you know, they don't always have to restrict the athlete. They might restrict them in the short term, but it could allow them to be more creative in the long term. So, for example, if you're saying to a player, right, you're not allowed to pass backwards unless it's a free kick, then although you've restricted them doing that, them being allowed to play forwards and explore, like, so many more angles and different possibilities on a pitch, they can sort of explore and, you know, diverge themselves along all these different opportunities. I think you're actually, you know, making them a better player, because they're seeing different things and just having that, you know, consequence in. And their teammates are running, right, don't give them backwards. Like, the centre back's going to say, do not give me the ball, play it forwards. And then, yeah, the kind of things that you get on the back of this from a technical point of view, a tactical point of view, psychologically, socially, that can be really beneficial. So yeah, restrict is a great one. Reward is great as well. So I think, especially if you're working with a player and use a few restrictions, I think it's equally good to be a reward. So if you're rewarding good behaviour, I think if they're at a stage where they're getting less than that 50% threshold mark, so for example, if they've had four shots and are only scoring one or two, say, right, if you do this, and, you know, you get another 10 minutes training, or you get a free session, or, you know, there's a bit of an incentive in there. And for me, that can be so many different ways that you can do that. But yeah, using rewards is a great way to build confidence. It's a great way for them to kind of structure and kind of, you know, work their way up the ladder in terms of executing that skill. Equally, I think the related ones are really good. So for me, when I use pressure norming training, there's probably a mix of three. So the related bit is the personal bit. So based on their ILP, so if they've got an individual learning plan, where they've got to try and finish off a couple of touches as opposed to taking 3-4 touches before the shoot, then yeah, maybe we might say, right, well, you know, think about trying taking, you know, what, you know, one or two touches, because that's, you know, you've got to be clinical. If you look at Jamie Vardy, he's taking short steps up to the ball. He's been really clinical in how he approaches it. So, you know, looking at how the best athletes do it, you know, can you try and do that? So the language is different. So can you try and do that? You know, just drop it in whenever you feel like it. Then when I start to get more success, then we can sort of like, right, now it's the pressure normal training. This is where the test comes in. This is where we might use a bit of reward or a bit of restriction. So we might actually use both at the same time. So there might be something on the line. So if they achieve that next challenge, so if they have 5 shots or if they have 5 opportunities to do something, if you say to them, right, if you complete this challenge, then you get a reward. But equally, if you don't complete the challenge, then there's something on the line for you. I think that's how you can use all 3 at the same time. So yeah, I think definitely through one-to-one coaching, individual coaching, you can certainly do it. And like I said, Calvin, who's a really, really sort of knowledgeable tennis coach, he works one-to-one with a lot of players. Sometimes it can work with team players, but I think sometimes it's about spinning these plates. So you know, if I'm working in a team environment, it might be 4 plates spinning at the same time. I probably won't do it for the whole team. But equally, if it's, you know, a couple of players and we can sort of have, you know, a couple of things to work on within a session with them. But yeah, there's so many ways in which you can use it. I think it's just about knowing the right time to use it, because if not, then yeah, you might lose that bit of trust, or they might not look at you the right way. You might not be the friend for a couple of weeks. So yeah. And look, you know, now if I had some right sort of death stares when I've put in some of the pressure and army interventions, but at the end of the session, they'd have come off it absolutely buzzing, whether they've achieved it or not achieved it. You know, they're really thankful for it. Reflect back to a girl on the blog, there's a couple of videos that she's featured on, and she was about to just go to America. So coached her for a couple of years. She played, you know, National League women's football, and, you know, really good player. Just about to go to America, and she said, yeah, I want to be pushed hard today. It's like, all right then, challenge accepted. And yeah, I don't think she quite knew what she was going to go into when she said that. And yeah, I remember she was playing the ball. She was playing the ball into a rebounder, and then she was going 1v1 against me. But I said, look, make it realistic, because I know how big the Americans are and the physical programs out there. And I said, look, you're going to need to cope with these transitions. If you don't get the ball back, then it's going to be a massive consequence for your team. So, you know, if you don't run 5 yards, then you're going to have to run 40 yards to then get the ball back on a second opportunity. And, you know, I had to think, how can I sell that to her? So, for example, she tried to play it into the rebounder, go around me, tried to get a shot off. But if I tackled her, I said, right, I'm stopping it in the centre circle. So we're just on the 18-yard. But then I stopped in the centre circle. I looked behind me and she was walking behind me. I was like, why are you not pressuring me? And it wasn't because she didn't want to do it. It's because she was feeling sorry for herself. She thought, yeah, I'm so mad at myself for not getting past me and, you know, getting the shot off. I said, look, if you don't run 5 yards here, then I'm going to make you run that 40 yards. So I made a run from the 18-yard box to the byline where the goal is, and then back to the 18-yard box within 6 seconds. And that was really tough. And I said, look, these are only going to get bigger and bigger. And by the end of the practice, you know, we have a really good relationship. There's a few tears in there. You know, she was really happy at the end of it. And then she did a testimony afterwards and said, look, you know, this kind of training has brought us closer together, both as friends. And, you know, I took my little boy out with her, with my wife, you know, went for a walk with her, and we didn't speak about anything to do with football at all. But because we've kind of built that relationship, and because we use that kind of pressure normal training, you know, we're kind of friends off the pitch as well. And building that coach athlete relationship, like I said, is absolutely critical. So yeah, for her to realize that if she cope with that transition and try to win a ball back, it would save her 40 yards of running, and then there's a little bit of buy-in towards the end of it. But yeah, I'd say for me, I'm only probably at that stage where I've got that close relationship with a handful of clients. I think you need to be working with them on quite a regular basis, or get to really know them Like she knows my family really well. I know her family really well. So, you know, that's probably a time where, yeah, you could probably do anything, try anything, and she'll probably say, yeah, I'm up for that challenge. She'll like, yeah, all right, then I'll have a go at that. There's something in there. So, yeah, I think that coach-athlete relationship is absolutely critical. Equally with lad who was on about, you know, he's playing in the Premier League at the moment, you know, been fortunate enough to know him over sort of 8-9 years. And I know what makes him tick. I know what he likes. I know what he hates. I know what he doesn't like. So, yeah, putting little challenges in like that, I think they absolutely thrive with it and they enjoy it. So, just knowing when to use them is really important. But, yeah, back to your point of using constraints, different types of constraints, restricting, rewarding, relating, how you shape your practice design. So that can bring about a natural occurrence or natural affordance, also known as ecological kind of constraints. But, yeah, for me, it's just about recognising the right ones to use.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what I absolutely love about this is it, you know, at a very basic level, it basically is representing the game and you know, that sort of a principle of non-linear pedagogy, which is very, you know, sort of in that ecological psychology, constraints-led approach. But, you know, I sort of listening to you now, I think about, you know, I can remember at the, you know, start of the season I did with my previous team and we were doing a load of one versus ones. And it was just so easy for the players. And then I think I come across a paper and it said, you know, actually players are more subjected to two versus ones or three versus one situations, particularly forwards. And I can remember just sort of changing it and then doing three versus one practice. And the players were like, well, this is so difficult, you know, we're struggling to cope and all this. And I just turned around and I went, yeah, but this is what you're going to be subjected to in the game. And, you know, it was hard for him. You know, you could certainly tell that. But, you know, when we got to that game on the Sunday, I remember it just completely transformed those attacking players we had. They were more able to cope with that environment. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely fascinating. And you know, I think sometimes as coaches, we're not always conscious to actually some of the idea around this pressure training is actually what is going to be required for that game on the Sunday anyway. But I suppose, you know, sort of linking with, you know, what you were saying there towards the end with the relationship with, you know, with these two particular players in question, really. I mean, I guess that really gets onto the third point of your blog about high challenge, but high support, doesn't it? And, you know, making sure that athlete feels that they are, you know, supported and even though this is really difficult and challenging for them at times, it's there to benefit them in the long run, right?
Yeah, I think there's kind of four. So there's a really good matrix in there, and I think I came across this a few years back as well. There's kind of four types of pressure and support that we can, or challenge and support that we can use. I think for me, high challenge with high support is probably one of the best ones because that, yeah, although the challenge is high, you're in there with them, you're getting stuck in, you're going through with them, and say, look, this is a consequence, but I'm going to do the consequence with you. So we're both in it, you know, like I'm going to stop you scoring, but equally that's a consequence for me because I want to make you a better player. I want to put you under real pressure. So using that support, you know, is really important, you know, having a challenge really high where, you know, something is almost just within their reach, but just out of reach at the same time. So it's on that kind of borderline of comfort zone. As long as it doesn't affect their well-being. So if they're pushed too hard, if they're being pushed to the point where, you know, they're being sick, or, you know, they're being pushed to the point where it's going to affect them for a few days, or it's going to affect the home life, then yeah, maybe we need to question it a little bit. But I think we can sort of notice these behaviours, both physically, like psychologically, we can notice these behaviours in our players. Yeah. and what to look out for. A lot of it's just common sense, really. You'd never want to put themselves into a situation where, you know, you're affecting their well-being. So that high challenge and high support is really important. I'll come back to that. But if we go to the other scale where the challenge is really high, but the support is really low, I think that there's value in doing that when you want to leave them to struggle a little bit. But if we do that too much and thinking, well, you know, why am I doing this? You know, what do I get out of it? Yeah. So yeah, there has to be an element of support in there. Now, what that support looks like, whether you can give them little pointers or maybe it's just questions. So I think I was working with a girl called Paige a few weeks ago. She was working on, so bearing in mind she's right footed, she just wanted to work on left footed free kicks. and she was craving detail from me. And bearing in mind, look, my technique is, you know, a lot of players that work with me, it's not the greatest, especially on my weaker foot. And she was craving technical information from me. And she was saying, you know, how should I approach the ball? You know, should I do it this way? Should I do it that way? And I said, look, I said, there's one thing you need to change in how you approach the ball. I'm not going to tell you what it is. There's one thing you need to change in how you approach it. And then the cogs start to turn a little bit, and I could see her going away and thinking about it. The first couple, she was experimenting in how to approach the ball. So a lot of the blog, there was a bit of research from David Allred, who was Johnny Wilkinson's coach. So, you know, the famous World Cup drop goal, you know, David Allred was all behind Johnny Wilkinson and that. And his research was basically saying, there's two types of run-ups to performing a technical execute, especially when it's a penalty or free kick, or in Johnny Wilkinson's case, like a penalty or a conversion to the goal in rugby. So he was basically saying that if you have like a C shape, so if you approach the ball like that, then there's more that can go wrong. And physically, there's more strain that you're going to put in your body in a run-up to the ball. So if you're running up to the ball like that, now I'm not saying that that is unsuccessful, because we look at Beckham, he was fantastic at a C-shaped run, but there's more value in doing what we call almost like a J-shape. So you like that, and then you come onto the ball a little bit more, because there's less that can go wrong. You think of it physically, when you approach the ball, there's less that can go wrong in the makeup in terms of how you approach it. And in terms of how your body responds, it kind of releases that anxiety a little bit more. So in terms of how we change our behaviours, I said to Paige, when you take this free kick, just change one thing about how you run up to it in terms of the angle of approach. She nailed it, and then she was absolutely buzzing afterwards when she dropped it in the top corner. And yeah, it took, don't get me wrong, it took her a long time to get up to that. But yeah, that little bit of support, you know, where I think sometimes where I'd be desperate to say, right, think about doing this, try and get your hips in this way, try and think about your follow through. I think if we overdo it, then if we give them too much explicit, you know, technical information, then that can maybe throw them off it. And there was a great point in the blog that I researched around like the use of like analogies and metaphors. So I'm trying to think of an example. So you look at maybe, you know, spoke to Calvin a lot about playing tennis. He said, well, you know, I've had a lot of challenge with players who are trying to backhand it. You know, they really struggle on the backhand. They struggle to keep their arm up there. And I said, I've done loads of technical coaching trying to do that, and I still can't do it. But then I dropped in an analogy, bit of a metaphor, saying, try and do it as though you're throwing a frisbee. So you've got them trying to throw a frisbee. And that was a great analogy. And in terms of how they process that, it's a little bit more informal. Maybe it got them to think about the childhood. So maybe it got them to think about, yeah, I love playing frisbee, and like I remember how to do it. And you could go through all the technical information you wanted, but that one sentence, that little metaphor, like sells it completely. And they can completely get it in a couple of space of time. And that was what I did with Paige. I used a C shape and a J shape analogy. I said, think about the C and the J, think about how you approach the ball. And that sometimes that's all you need to say to players, especially high performing athletes. You know, even players that are a little bit younger. For me, it's about allowing them to explore loads of different options, even if it means them struggling in the short term. Yeah. I think the skill, and that's probably what I've refined over the last couple of years, is just recognizing when to go in and support them, but equally when to keep the challenge high but not support them as much. But yeah, if you're looking at a really good area, you probably want to be having that high challenger support, but also supporting them highly, but also having the challenge high as well, because that's when they're going to really thrive under pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it links into that idea, doesn't it, of implicit learning, where, you know, like you say, I think that school of thought talks about, if you provide too much technical instruction, then the athlete really does, going back to your point of choking, they begin to choke under that pressure, because they just, you know, they can't just extract that information from their mind on how to perform a skill. But, you know, whereas if you're using your analogies and you know, just giving them a little carrot, should we say, of something to think about, then there's more chance that they go and perform that. So, yeah, I mean, again, some really fascinating insights there, you know, from what you've just shared. And, you know, to me, listening to you there, it really does link back, doesn't it, to, you know, the first point of understanding your athlete and having that coach-athlete relationship, you know, like you say, understanding, you know, how much challenge you can subject them to and maybe how much of support they're going to need as well. And, you know, sort of really tailoring that pressure training to each individual athlete that you're working with. I mean, would that be right to say?
Yeah, tailoring it to each athlete that you work with. I think equally with that, it's important to get them to frame their perspective. So like I said earlier, like pressure, sometimes it's not always tangible. It's based on what they perceive. So for example, there's a great video that I watched and it was about this American basketball team who thought that because they were going to one of the national venues, they thought that the net was higher and things were a little bit further away. So what the coach did to kind of reduce that pressure and reduce them thinking all the negative things about it, getting into that environment, he took him, I can't remember, it might have been a Hoosiers film, but basically took him to the gym and he got a measuring tape and he measured out from the base, from the floor up to the net. And he said, look, this is no different to our own gym. And he said, right, take the ball to the three-pointer, see if that's the same distance, exactly the same distance. I said, well, what are you worrying about? It's exactly the same conditions. So, yeah, in terms of getting them to frame that, it gets them to kind of internalize and approach that pressure, what would be a pressure situation, a little bit more of a better way. Yeah. Another one is where I think back at Derby Women when I was there a few years ago, was playing against I think it was West Brom, a really good team. And, you know, a lot of the players were thinking, how are we going to get through this game? And John Griffiths, who was coaching at the time, you know, really good mentor, he said, look, take it as 91-minute games. So that's getting them to reframe and change their perspective. I know it sounds so simple, but play each game of 91-minute games. Like, don't think about getting through to half-time or don't think about, you know, a lot of I think at Loughborough Foxes, what we do now is we try and plan like each 15 minutes. So try and get through this 15-minute period. So try and chunk the performance down. And when we get them to chunk it down, look, it's the same amount of time. It's still 90 minutes, but getting them to take it 1 minute at a time. If, for example, something doesn't go right, the next minute, right, it's a new minute, take it onto the next behavior, take it onto the next action. It just gets them to reframe and change their perspective on things a little bit differently. So yeah, altering their thinking. Yeah, there's many instances where I've used like these kind of analogies or use these kind of frames just to try and change athletes' perspectives. And for me, it's just allowing them to think, well, actually, it's not that much of a big pressure moment. You know, I've done this before. So it's that self-efficacy theory. I've done it in training, so I can do it again. There's no reason why I can't. Yeah. So, yeah, whilst we can't fill the stadium with, you know, especially now, there's a lot of athletes that we'll work with have like empty stadiums. Like, how do you motivate yourself without having all the crowd in there? There's a lot of teams that have been affected by that and individuals as well. So a big point is the penalties. You know, I think the penalty rate has gone up significantly in lockdown, you know, with the new wave of, like, you know, a lot of success being in penalties. There's been far more penalties that have gone in through lockdown, and with the goalkeeper rule where they can't come off the line, that's a massive restraint. So there's a lot more penalties. But equally, you know, some athletes almost like thrive off having that crowd in there, you know, because it allows them to sequence and time their approach to the ball. So then we think, well, how can we create that? So with the with a couple of players, what we've done is we've had a whistle, we've put in constraints in there, right? If you don't score this, then the next one, you have to score your right foot, and then the consequence on the back of that. So you're reducing their chances of scoring the next one, and then there's a big consequence on the back of that. Then, yeah, it, you know, although that's completely not related to, you know, the crowd being or the consequence of losing a game, you're just getting them used to, like, something being on the line. For me, if something's not on the line, then, yeah, we're not preparing athletes for the right situations.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant, Richard. I mean, it's such a fascinating insight, and you're right, you know, sometimes, you know, people are probably listening to this and thinking, well, you know, that seems quite simple, you know, getting athletes to reframe their mindset, but it certainly isn't. You know, it's something that, you know, I think certainly needs to be more conscious to coaches, which is, you know, brilliant by sharing those examples today.
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
So yeah, you know, I'm a bit conscious of time. You know, I want to be respectful to your time, and you know, it's been a fantastic conversation so far. So if we move on to our last segment, which is always, you know, a summary of what we've discussed, and then we discuss the implications for coaching practice. So, you know, for me, I suppose my first question would be, you know, to the coach listening to this today, and you know, they're thinking, okay, so how do I, you know, with my under eights, for example, really begin now to maybe just incorporate a bit of this pressurized training? What are the implications they need to be aware of? I know we've been over that in the last in the last segment, just discussing those points. But if you could just to re-summarize and just the implications coaches should be aware of for introducing pressurized training.
Yeah, for me, I try and instruct a lot of my coaching in terms of like the 5 W's. So I think instead of starting with when to introduce it, I think it's got to be the what and the why. So if you're working with under eights, what do I want them to achieve out of that session? You know, do I want them to be more confident, you know, playing out from the back? Do we want more goals? You know, what do we want to achieve? And then we've got to think about, well, you know, then what constraint can we use to bring out of that? And then it begins with like the other W's, you know, why are we using that? So, you know, does that constraint bring out more negative behaviours than positive behaviours? Is it actual kind of intuitive to what we want to do? So, you know, bringing out these constraints, you've got to be really, you've got to be almost creative in the way that you do it. But I know it's a little bit of, you know, sort of going back on my words, but you've got to be creative, but also at the same time, there's got to be a little bit of a method and a rationale to why you're doing it. So, yeah, with younger players, you've got to be mindful about their sort of physical well-being. You know, they're not fully formed physically. You know, they're going to go through different growth spurts. So little challenges where, you know, you might think, yeah, there's got to be a physical consequence. You might use like social stuff, or you might have something else like Jaffa cakes, or you might have something like they've got to do something back home that they don't necessarily do, right? I've used ones where, you know, you've got to kiss your sister, and like the lads absolutely hate that, or you've got to say, right, you've got to tell your sister you love her, and say, no, I can't do that. So yeah, little things like that. So you could have something simple, for example, saying, look, if you want to play it from the back, you might have a couple of constraints in there. You might say you've either got to play off one touch or you've got to run with the ball. So what will happen is the movement off the ball will be a lot better if you know that, you know, either I've got a clear space for someone to run through with it, or I've got to put myself in a position where I can play off one touch. So then you get like third man runs. So just like putting little constraints in there, you can have more sort of realistic expectations on the back of it. So yeah, those 5 W's are really important. You know, what do we want to achieve? Why are we using this constraint? Why are we using this pressure training? And then equally, what's going to be on the line? So what do they get out of it? What's the reward? So is there like a forfeit for the team that does it well? Is there a reward for both teams for at least trying it? So do you want to reward the behaviour rather than the outcome? Because I think that's more important with younger players in terms of, like, I think how many times does a player try and take somebody on, and then we go back and say, well, you should have passed it, or you should have kicked out of play instead. Well, actually, no. Well, it's probably not the decision they've made. It's probably more the execution of it. So if you have a bad decision and a bad execution, then 9 times out of 10, there's probably going to be a goal conceded. So if a goalkeeper's trying to play out from the back, and if they pass to a player that's under pressure, but they drill it into their feet, it's probably a bad decision, but they've executed it really well, so they've got away with it. Yeah. But if we get to a point where, you know, it's a good decision, so maybe they tried to play to a player who was completely open in space, and maybe they're the right player, because if they're fan them, then maybe we could open up another side of the pitch. But maybe we might have executed it a little bit wrong, so or maybe in terms of how we approach the ball. So then, for me, it's about how do we approach that. And yeah, if we're constantly trying to get them to change their decision and not stick with the right execution, then they're never going to be prepared for pressure situations. So yeah, with younger players, definitely praise the process. You know, if they're trying something that looks a good decision, and you ask them, why did you try that? What do you expect the outcome to be when you did that? Then yeah, I think that's fundamentally critical to what you're trying to do. But younger players, yeah, definitely consider what you put in and why you do it. How you use this pressure training. Probably wouldn't use it all the time. Just drop it in, maybe like session before the game.
Yeah.
And then, you know, linking back to what I said earlier, knowing what constraints you're going to use, why you're going to use them, how you can combine challenge and support. And then probably the most critical factor is the personal qualities of the athlete. Are they ready for it? Are they in the right moods? What's been leading up to it? And yeah, coach-athlete relationship has to be a fundamental, most important part. If that isn't in place, then yeah, you're probably going to affect the relationship a little bit negatively if that's not in place. But yeah, but yeah, they're the kind of main points for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing that's that really comes to me that I guess is the overriding features, you know, just understanding if it's age appropriate, you know, not in terms of the pressure training, sorry, but in terms of, you know, what type of pressure training you're doing, what constraints are you doing, what language are you using, you know, things like that, and just understanding what's suitable for the athlete and, like you say, their well-being at, you know, certain times. How are they feeling today? You know, is it good to subject them to that today? Actually, maybe they've had a tough week at school. Maybe we'll leave that today. So no, Richard, absolutely brilliant. I mean, I think that is, you know, as episodes go, that's certainly one of the most insightful today, particularly for me, and I'm sure for all the listeners as well. I've fully enjoyed listening, you know, and learning a lot more about pressure training today, and, you know, and the importance of it, and really as coaches, how we begin to implement that within our practice. So, you know, shame I'm not coaching. I'd love to go and implement some of these ideas into a session tomorrow, but that's a problem, isn't it? But Richard, yeah, I mean, absolutely brilliant. Seriously, I thought that was a really good episode. I mean, I don't know if there's any additional points you'd like to add just before we finish.
No, yeah, just consider those points. Definitely try it. The athletes will look, you know, enter that conversation with the athletes. Look, we're going to try a bit of pressure training today, building them up to it. And then when you get to a stage where you're using it quite consistently, then you can use it more spontaneously, where you can just drop it in whenever they get 50 to 75% success. When they're in that sweet spot, just drop it in. But
yeah,
you do need to have that conversation with athletes. Look, we did this pressure training because it helps you more in this situation. Remember when you did this? This is why we're doing pressure training. This is why I'm putting you in these situations. Unless you don't have, if you don't have those conversations, then yeah, it's going to sort of negatively affect the relationship. So yeah, definitely prepare them up for it. It's not, you can't spontaneously use it straight away. There has to be a rationale in there. But yeah, like you said, I just want to get back out on the grass now to start coaching.
I certainly know the feeling. No, brilliant, brilliant, Richard. So yeah, for the listeners, where can we find you on social media? Where can we find out about RDA coaching? You know, what would be the best social media platform to find out a bit more?
Yes, RDA coaching, we're on, we'll be on YouTube soon, but the main platforms are Instagram, Facebook and Twitter, RDA coaching or RDA underscore coaching. Equally, if you want to get to my personal account, Richard_Allen5 on Twitter. And yeah, let's have a conversation. Let's see where it can go. So, you know, looking to try and learn, especially in this period where I kind of can't get out of the grass, trying to get as many ideas as possible.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. Well, Richard, it just leaves me to say thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Not many would want to talk to me on a Sunday morning at nine in the morning. So I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate, you know, what you've brought to the podcast. I think that's an episode that is very informative to coaching, certainly a topic that I personally think probably just needs a bit more direction in the academic world. But no, absolutely brilliant. Have you enjoyed it? First experience on a podcast, I believe, was it?
Yeah, debut on a podcast, to be fair. So yeah, absolutely loved it. So yeah, hopefully it's been useful for anyone out there. But yeah, equally, I've got loads out of it. So yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
No, certainly a pleasure. And just leaves me to thank everyone once again for whether you're watching us on YouTube today or if you're listening to the podcast on our various platforms. Thanks, as always, for tuning in and listening to the podcast today. And as always, any questions, please do get in touch. And please leave us a review if you like the podcast on our platforms. It certainly helps grow us. So thanks, Richard, once again. Thanks to all our listeners. And we will be back next week.